We hope you enjoy this ABC Radio National podcast, and there are many more to choose from, including our daily current affairs breakfast, and we'll have details on that after the program. But right now, turn up your volume so you can fully appreciate the dynamic range of the audio.
All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, and a welcome from me, Natasha Mitchell. Over the next three shows, I'm taking you up the line to Goodna, as the saying goes, unearthing the incredible, difficult, often moving stories of Australia's longest-running asylum, warts and all recollections of madness, cure, care and abuse. This Queensland site has housed 50,000 people over its 150 years, and a recent exhibition at the Museum of Brisbane really helped bring together former patients, staff and families for the first time to break the silence over its history. But there are many histories here, some painful, some magical, as with the two sisters who grew up on the grounds from the 1920s. And this won't be a strict chronology. This week, confronting stories from as recent as the 1980s and 90s. Starting, though, with Marina, who today lives in the park, Centre for Mental Health, as it's now called, and has for much of her life. Her colourful paintings, which she sells, adorns the walls of what is a very different place to what she arrived at in the early 70s.
Captive Alston is a place of misery. When you get there, there's a signpost. Don't believe upon the day. Don't believers is a pack of fucking lies. If it wasn't for the nurses, we'll be in paradise. Build the bonfire, put the nurses on the top. Put the doctors among the nurses and burn the bloody lot. And burn the bloody lot. I made it up.
The food was terrible. Like water with garlic, castor oil water with watery castor oil with milk in it. Half stale. The milk was 20 days old. Boy, 20 days old. Could have been sick as a dog. Mm. Horrible those days, you can believe with that.
So now you cook your own.
No, what a difference. My lady takes me to the shops and goes shopping. Every Monday I go shopping.
It was originally Woogaroo Lunatic Asylum. It became Goodna Hospital for the Insane. Then it was Mental Hospital Goodna. Then it was Brisbane Special Hospital, probably the most euphemistic of all. Then it became Wolston Park Hospital, and that was from about the 60s. So a lot of people here also know it as Wally Park, Wolston Park. Now it's called the Park Centre for Mental Health.
Okay, we're halfway, almost halfway between Brisbane and Ipswich. We're on the banks of the Brisbane River, on the Goodna Reach of the Brisbane River. It was a site that was part of the Woogaroo station and was acquired by the government specifically to build this hospital, which was called the Woogaroo Lunatic Asylum. I think there's close to 600 acres in the whole site.
But this whole region is interesting. When you look at the map, there are multiple correctional facilities, prisons, there's the Park Mental Health Centre now, the old asylum site. It's a sort of region of otherness, isn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, that was the whole idea of building, you know, the term, you know, going up the line to Goodna was a part of colloquial speech, which, you know, was a threat sometimes used, you know, if you don't behave yourself, you'll go up the line to Goodna. And it was up, out of sight, out of mind.
This is an emotional experience coming to this exhibition. This is about real people and real lives. Well, hi, I'm Jo Besley. I'm a curator here at Museum of Brisbane, and I worked with a team to put together the Remembering Goodna exhibition. It was Queensland's longest operating, oldest and largest mental hospital, and it was established in 1865, so we're talking about 150 years of history. And it's really about shedding light on that place that was so hidden and yet such an important part of our history. By the mid-1950s, there were over 2,500 patients.
Where were people who were deemed insane sent before the institution was built at Goodna?
Well, before Queensland was a self-governing colony, they went down to New South Wales, apparently, to Tarbert Creek, one of the really old asylums down there. Then they went to Petrie Terrace Jail. I think the earliest correspondence about Goodner, about building the asylum, was in the early 1860s. So it was actually one of the first things that the Queensland colonial government did as a government.
So the story of Goodner is in fact, in a sense, parallels the story of Queensland.
Exactly, that's exactly right.
I'm Mark Fernand. I work at Griffith University. I'm a historian.
You've dug deep into the history of this site and the hospital. Who were the first patients?
They were a group of people who were housed in the Brisbane jail. They were actually transported in January 1865 on a little steamer up the Brisbane River. The steamer was called, in extraordinary fashion, I think, it was called the Settler. This, of course, was a very peculiar kind of settlement.
A lot of the patients were male itinerant rural workers who had nowhere else to go. I think in the 19th century the place was a real dumping ground. You had every type of diagnosis, people with acquired brain injuries, lots of people who had had accidents and had nowhere else to go, lots of people with epilepsy, diseases we don't even recognise as mental illnesses today. And then there's a big shift in the 20th century to more women and more neurotic type of conditions, whereas the 19th century really seemed like the lonely shepherd, the lonely alcoholic shepherd who had nowhere to go in his old age. Mm. And a lot of poor people, I think. There was no public health system, no nursing homes, so that's where people ended up.
Walking up over a very windy hill here. There's a very old building, actually weatherboard and tin and sandstone, beautiful, but now obviously a bit derelict.
Yes, this was the what was called female tree. I remember a staff member telling me that housed around 300 female patients, which would have led to quite a severe case of overcrowding.
I'm Nadia Beer. I'm the consumer advocate at the Park Centre for Mental Health. I started here in 1973. I was a newly graduated psychologist and came here as a group of psychologists that came into the service.
Around the back of this building there are some what patients call the dungeons, but are really seclusion rooms that are sort of under the building. We can get a sense of how traumatic it would have been for patients who would have been housed in those very narrow, cold, damp rooms. That
concrete walls. And steel bars are really locked in.
And I think in those days, not necessarily people who were aggressive, it would have been people who would have been floridly mentally ill, which is a sadness in itself, really. Patients who experienced this have never forgotten that experience and will talk about it as a real traumatic experience in their life.
What sorts of stories have you heard?
I've heard stories about patients being put down there, being cold and damp, of a sense of being forgotten, you know, because as you can see, it doesn't really connect in any way to the upstairs where the bulk of the patients and staff would have been. This sense of being locked away in the dark forever, which would have been an incredible fear, and I think that's why the trauma stays with people.
How have seclusion or isolation rooms changed?
Certainly the standards these days are different. They are still sparsely furnished, but they have toilet facilities. There is a requirement that there's the clock in view so that patients in seclusion have some sense of time and how long they're being there. And certainly their needs, they need to be observed every 15 minutes or so on so that there's a...
But no TV, no radio, no toilet seat.
No, in the high secure ones, no toilet seat. And quite difficult. Patients do still talk about the difficulty of coping with that.
Is there a time limit on how long someone can be put in isolation?
The current Mental Health Act requires seclusion to be authorised by a doctor every 12 hours.
But realistically, people stay in seclusion for a lot longer than 12 hours.
That's right. People could be in there for several days, weeks at a time as well.
At 15, you were sent to Wollstone Park Hospital, Goodner, the asylum, and you were a child put into an adult institution.
After I was transferred, the nurse that took me to Goodner She cried the whole way in the ambulance. She couldn't believe it. She just kept holding me. I'm Sue Treweek. I represent a group who, as state wards, were placed into adult mental health institutions, which was covered by the Ford Inquiry under the systems abuse, and then again in the 2004 Senate Inquiry into the Abuse of Children in Institutional Care. I'm now 42. I was escaped from Goodna in 1988, and since then I've managed to pull my life back together and I'm back.
And you'd been in and out of institutions, hadn't you, your whole life? So what were the circumstances that led you to become a ward of the state?
Abuse and neglect. My auntie was told me of one instance where she was called to my mother's house because the police wanted me removed, but nobody would touch me because I was so filthy. I was a six-month-old baby. I was ulcerated from not having my nappy changed. The bottle was left in my cot, which had solidified. I was malnourished, and they just kept giving me back to my mother. So I was in and out of foster care and children's homes. I have memories of the police crashing our door down because my mother was often with people that used drugs, and there was a lot of violence in my life. Mm. Until I was about 12, I just couldn't take any more of the abuse with my mother. So they put me into a place called Warilda Children's Home. And by this point, I think that I'd already had a nervous breakdown, if you can have one so young. And the doctor who had known me since I was very young, he did all the children's homes, decided to put me on a drug called Mallorol because I shook a lot. And he said, "You're a very nervy child." So he put me on a major tranquilizer, a psychotropic drug.
At 12.
And I had no breasts. I was quite undeveloped and small for my age. And I started to lactate, and I was always dizzy. I was falling asleep in class. I was getting in trouble at school. I started to become more aggressive. Not to other people. I wasn't violent. But I'd yell. I think I'd learnt that skill as a small child in the orphanage when there was lots of kids, that if I yelled or screamed, people would back off from me and leave me alone. And I used to rock myself to sleep, and I still wet the bed. I was almost 13. And so they decided that I must be retarded. So they sent me to an adult mental health institution, which was Lowson House. In my view, it was government-sanctioned abuse, government-sanctioned child abuse.
Well, it is a very intense painting. It shows a figure on a bed and a spider and a hand, and basically her heart is being ripped out, and then there's a frightened child underneath the bed. This is a painting that was done about the experiences of a young woman who was sent there when she was about 15. She was a ward of the state, and she should never have ended up in an adult ward for the criminally insane, but she did. And while she was there, she was assaulted, sexually assaulted. Another woman that knew her, because she herself had grown up in an orphanage, she painted this painting, and she said the spider just came to her as a symbol. And then later, when she showed the painting to the woman whose experiences she was painting about, she said, "I always imagined the department as a spider that had too many legs in my life, you know."
They took me by ambulance from Lowson House to Goodna. And I'd only heard from other patients what Goodna was like. I didn't really have any idea.
You were 15. Take us back, if you can, to day one.
All the patients were having their lunch in Osler House, including some very well-known people.
And you were put into a high-security forensic mental health unit within Goodna.
Yes, there was one lady there who'd killed all of her kids. Only one survived. Hacked them to death with a hoe. There was other people who couldn't be out of Osler House because I was so violent. When I walked in, everybody's turned and stared at me, and just the shocked look on their face, because I was the size of an average 11, 12-year-old and definitely didn't look like I needed to be there. There was one woman, she jumped up and attacked me. Just started punching into me and pulling my hair. That's when, because I had to be processed, so they had to strip search me. I had to bend over and all that sort of stuff. And they came out with this big umbrella dress and these pair of undies, because I didn't have any belongings. What I owned in the whole world would fit into a small paper bag. They had clothes there, because you all had to wear the same clothes. And these big umbrella dresses dragged along the ground. I was too small. And the undies, I had to tie a knot in the side just to keep them up.
Did anyone give any rationale to you as a 15-year-old as to why you were at a mental hospital?
Just that they couldn't keep me at Lowson House any longer because I'd been there too long and they didn't know where else to put me. But by the time I hit Osler House, I had started to self-mutilate. And I think in the very beginning, it was attention-seeking. It's like, look, I'm hurting myself. I can't take this anymore. Somebody do something. And then it became more of like an addiction of where I felt that I had to hurt myself. I'd punch walls and things because I was so bad. I had to make myself better. And by that time, I was also addicted to the medication.
What, Sue, was the hospital environment like? Because you were in and out over 8 years, weren't you?
I think the longest I was ever out of Wolston Park was 2.5 months. But what was most frightening and most debilitating for me as a young teenager was the fact that it was the hopelessness and there was nothing to do. Your whole day was ran by meal times and medication times. That's how you knew what time it was. That's how you knew that the day was nearly over.
Despair and the devastation is difficult to relate to people who haven't seen or who weren't there. It was one of great abuse and neglect. There were a lot of people who were trying very hard with not the right tools and inadequate resources and well-intentioned people, but there was also a whole universe of wrongness. Philosophies have changed and models of care have changed and hopefully things are much, much better. And it's certainly the worst issues of abuse and neglect. The institutional issues have been addressed, I think, but there's still a huge amount of work to do in the community. My name is Dr. Paul White. I'm a psychiatrist at the park. Treatment was a lot less helpful than it is these days, and very much the emphasis was on the control of behaviour and not on person-centred trying to help people recover and rehabilitate from their illnesses. Mr. Burdekin described Pearce and Osler House as the two worst units in Australia.
They were two houses on this site.
And they were the first units I took over as a young psychiatrist. They were in the process of being closed, but Pearce House, which was a male unit, there were 28 men. There was one bathroom, there was a communal eating centre, and all of the men slept in one room on wrought iron frame beds. And then were put out into the fenced yard that had a 30-foot fence around it for the rest of the day. There were, I think, 4 or 5 seclusion rooms, and it was regular that all of those seclusion rooms would be full. As an example, this complex now has one seclusion room. And there was often a bizarre notion for me, but there was often a waiting list for people to be put into seclusion because they were so violent. The female unit was similarly appalling. I can remember the first day I walked in thinking that running away was a good thing. That meant that you at least still had some sense of yourself left. There were a lot of people who really didn't need to be here. The reasons for them being institutionalised or locked up were really quite idiosyncratic, and a lot of the problems that occurred were because people were locked up for no good reason, and a lot of those problems disappeared by opening the doors and letting people out.
Comes and goes in the rain like an old man.
And then eventually they transferred to me a ward called Noble House B, which was men and women. So not only did I have the criminally insane women to deal with, I then had men as well, because some of those men were there for crimes against children, and guess what, I looked like a child. And being heavily medicated meant that sometimes I couldn't always defend myself against those men. But sometimes the staff were worse than the patients. They were more violent and more, they'd set you up. You'd get set up. There was two Jasons. There was Jason who was, he had schizophrenia, and he was messed up really bad in Pearce House. He was sexually assaulted in Pearce House. He was very sick as far as his schizophrenia, you know, which I didn't understand at all. So him and I, you know, we'd run away and we'd go to the pub, but he heard voices and stuff, and by now I was quite okay with that. That was a normality, that people heard voices and all this stuff. Jason eventually committed suicide. He went under a train. Then there was another Jason who was 16. He was a little fella. Well, I call him a little fella because he was... And I don't like using this term, but I don't know what other term to use. Jason was a vegetable. He had, I think it was either Huntington's or Parkinson's, the one that makes all your muscles and everything waste away. His mind was completely there. He was in a semi-locked ward, which was McDonald House B. And they had a mattress in the middle of the lounge room, and that's where he lived. And that's where he peed and pooed and spewed. And I've seen people urinate on him. I've seen people kick him, walk over him. Because Jason couldn't talk, but he could make sounds. And he used to call me Oos, Oos, Oos. But then one day, a nurse walked in, a male nurse walked in. I could see that Jason wanted to go to the toilet because he was restless, you know. This nurse has walked past Jason's, because he couldn't grab, Jason could not grab anything, no strength in him. He tried to grab this nurse's leg of his trousers, like just brushed it. The nurse turned around and kicked Jason's front teeth out. And eventually what happened with Jason was, I remember his mother came. His mother and these people in suits came and got Jason, because I think the nursing home suddenly decided, oh, well, we'll take him. He was only there because there was nowhere else for him.
We're remembering Goodna over the next 3 weeks on All in the Mind, Australia's oldest and largest asylum in Queensland. I'm Natasha Mitchell here on ABC Radio National and Radio Australia. Joe Besley, you encountered many conflicting versions of the past in putting together this exhibition.
Yes, we did, and that was quite tricky because, well, we weren't really interested in presenting the truth. I don't think that's what it's about. So what we tried to do was just actually put those conflicting stories side by side.
So what were the major conflicting points of view that you found in gathering material?
I guess it was probably about the treatment of the patients by the staff and about issues like violence and death and suicide. I mean, I met former staff members who said there was never any suicides there and, there was never any violence. And other staff members who willingly said it was a very violent place, but, you know, you're talking about people who are psychotic and they could rationalise the violence. And then patients just talking about their experiences. And I think that when you're talking about traumatic memories, I'm sure that that sometimes makes remembering those things very hard. That sort of overlaid it all as well for both staff and patients. Mm. One aspect that I found interesting was about towels, and we've got a towel on display because towels were actually used by some of the staff members to injure people without leaving any marks. So they would loop the towel around someone's neck and then people's heads were bashed against the walls. But I also heard stories of violence, patients against staff. So I met a woman who had been beaten by a patient and half her face is semi-paralysed as a result. I also met someone whose brother, as a staff member, was badly beaten by a patient. His jaw was broken. We heard lots of stories about violence between patients, people getting angry. So I heard a lot of stories of violence.
What about sexual abuse?
There are stories about, yeah, sexual abuse, again, between staff and patients and also between patients.
Whereas some people who, they may never have got a harsh word from a staff member. They may have conformed and been very good patients and, you know, as we used to call them, workers. I fully accept their side, but I do find it very difficult to believe that they didn't witness any abuse. But I'm not going to, you know, question their history.
Tell me about the child that you had.
My son. In 1983, I was sexually assaulted at Goodna. Subsequently became pregnant. They didn't find out I was pregnant until I was about 5 months. But I was continually given ECT through that time. I know through my files that an application was made to have the child aborted. The Royal Women's Hospital wouldn't do it because it was too far gone. I was counselled at no end by staff, doctors, social workers, how I could never be a mother. My consultant, who I'd known since my first day there, told me that I would never be released from Goodna. When my son was adopted, that's probably the closest they ever came to shattering my spirit. When I had my son, I was 19. I escaped when I was 23, so it was another 4 years after that before I got out. When I went into labour and they've raced me off to the hospital didn't want me there because I was a mental patient. He had these beautiful blue eyes and he just looked straight at me. I bonded instantly with that child. I think I'd bonded before he was even born because when I was feeling him moving around, I was in the isolation cells laying there naked. That's just him and me, you know. I stayed at Goodna for another 4 years after my son was born. Those 4 years are very sketchy for me because I think that's the closest they ever came to killing me inside. It was when they took my boy. But eventually something happened. But this nurse, Harvey, said, "Sue, you've been so much trouble." I can't remember his exact words. "You've been so much trouble over the years. They're going to put you in Osler House. You will never get another chance to get away." Something about they were going to section me so that they didn't have to apply for through their tribunal to keep me there. So I would have been section regulated indefinitely. Never a chance, another chance to get out. And I would have become like a couple of the other women that I knew. There was one girl, Michelle. She'd been in Osler House long before my time. She was probably only about 3 years older than me. And to this day, I don't know what happened to her, but she never ever got out of Osler House. She wasn't violent. That's just where she stayed. I never once ever saw her leave those doors. After the Harvey let me out, he said, "Don't come back. This means my job."
You were 23?
23. My living skills were about that of a, I'd say, an 8-9-year-old, as far as being able to live and survive out in society. I ended up going out into the bush. I had a pillowcase, a little puppy, and a sleeping bag, and off I went out in the bush, and here I am now. Huge, long journey and healing journey, and I got off all the medication, and that was the best thing I ever did, because when I got off all the medication, I started to be able to control my own behaviour. It was like everything had always had like a big film around it, and I couldn't really feel what it actually felt like. But for about 2 years after I got out, it was like in the back of my mind, subconsciously, I was still waiting for somebody to tell me to get out of bed, and somebody to tell me that I could eat, somebody to tell me it was time to go to bed.
Institutionalised.
Yes, yes, profoundly. To the point where I'd feel quite like I was being naughty. But about a year and a half after I got out, I started to realise that, hey, I can do this. I can live out here.
Seeing the human suffering was intolerable. It was enraging, it was cause for despair, and it had to change. Virtually all of the old wards are now closed, and there was a new, much more modern facility built that has individual rooms and en suites. There's an expectation that when people come to stay that they're not staying for their whole lives, that we're part of a process to help people address the psychological and social issues and spiritual issues in their lives. There's a much greater emphasis on maintaining the social networks that people have and help people keep their families involved at times that are often very difficult.
A lot of patients would say, what's this psychiatrist reflecting on a history of human rights abuses in institutions in the past when psychiatrists were culpable?
Absolutely. There's very good evidence that psychiatry has been misused in the most appalling ways to deprive people of their rights and of their humanity. I don't think that that means that we can't be advocates for our patients. We're probably in the best position if we see the need to do that. That it's not done more regularly is, I think, one of the tragedies of my profession.
Dr. Paul White, a psychiatrist at the Park Centre for Mental Health near Ipswich in Queensland, and before him Sue Treweek, who last year, after a long search, found the son she had at Goodna 23 years ago, and he's come to live and work with her. Now the mother of four daughters, Sue runs a business called No Problems Cleaning, through which she's solving all sorts of problems, building partnerships to help families in crisis and former residents. Next week, Beyond the Stark Walls, Straitjackets, Sedatives and Silent Movies. A nurse who spent 40 years at Goodna from World War II and two sisters who grew up on the site with their matron aunt. Transcripts, audio and more on our website abc.net.au/rn/allinthemind, along with my blog. And my thanks to Mark Fernane and to Joe Besley, curator of the Remembering Goodna exhibition with the Museum of Brisbane, and to Anita Barrow and Kerry Dell. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Last words to Sue Treweek.
I don't think that the road has to be so hard. I could see that the community itself, especially with mental illness, how hard is it to smile at somebody who looks like they're doing it hard? How hard is it to give somebody a smile and make them feel a part of the community, or that somebody's there that acknowledges their existence?
You've tried to get your case heard.
I wanted them firstly to acknowledge that what they'd done to us children was wrong. I wanted justice for people like Jason and people who can't speak out for themselves, who I know were abused. I saw it. A lot of the times when people did the bad things to us, they'd say, well, who's ever going to listen to you? My sociology professor, when I was studying youth work, when I did my first assignment on social justice, I totally failed. He's just looked at me and he's gone, you have no concept of social justice. Well, I didn't. I didn't, but I do now.
If you're not a morning person, the bad news is you're missing the best and most listened to breakfast radio in Australia. The good news is that online, Radio National serving breakfast all day, and everything's on the menu. You pick and choose. The full program, separate stories, subject or commentator. Subscribe and we'll deliver. Details at the Radio National website. Breakfast, it's your choice.